jet substructure of the ocean.
Yes, thanks. I was told to use this. Yeah, thanks for having me. I would like to talk about jet substructure at the LHC, kind of a hot topic recently. So why are we interested in jets? So at the LHC, we have some objects which we can observe, like leptons, missing energy, photons, or jets. And from those jets, or from those visible objects, we try to get a clue of the underlying theory, like standard model or BSM. Jets are probably the most complicated objects because they don't only consist of one elementary particle or something like that, but of a bunch of particles. And they evolve over different energy scales. And further, jets have a spatial extent which other objects here not necessarily have. So we are interested in jets also because most of the objects we are trying to reconstruct have a big branching ratio into jets. Okay, so the outline of the talk is, first I'd like to discuss in which scenario subjet techniques are useful and are applied these days. Then I'd like to discuss what jets are, what is all about jets, and why is it so difficult to treat them reasonably. Then which subjet techniques are there, which are used, and what's their advantages. And finally, I apply those techniques to some examples to show really the payoff of those techniques in phenomenological studies. So one naturally scenario is the highly boosted scenario. More or less what you have is you produce a heavy resonance, BSM resonance usually, like a C prime or a color octet, Kaluza-Klein resonance or something like that. This decays into some intermediately heavy particle, can be from the standard model or BSM, let's say a top, a Higgs, a Z or a W. And if you have a huge release in rest mass from a heavy guy, those guys are going to be highly boosted. And the decay products of those things, because they might decay to jets, like for example the top, they will be highly collimated. So they will end up in a very narrow region of your detector. And the problem is now to reconstruct this stuff. This is particularly difficult because you would like to reconstruct only the, only the final state of those guys, final state radiation here. But you don't want to pick up underlying event contributions, initial state radiation, which is not directly related to your hard interaction matrix element. And if you, for example, have a big cone and you try to catch all the final state radiation in a big cone, you will eventually catch a lot of underlying event initial state radiation. And it makes it very difficult to reconstruct the resonance you're interested in. This is the naturally boosted scenario. Then there's the scenario where you have just a proton-proton collision and you produce something like a standard model particle or a BSM particle which is only intermediately hard boosted. Like, for example, a production of a Higgs and a Z where the Higgs recoils against the Z boson. Those guys have usually a steeply falling PT distribution. But it has been shown that it can be advantageous to focus on highly boosted objects in such a final state to gain in signal over background ratio, because the background usually tends to be even less boosted than the signal. And you have less problems with kinematics or combinatorics in this sense, because a Higgs which decays to two jets in the whole detector, it's difficult to discriminate from other jets which are generated in the event, while if you have a highly boosted object, the decay products will again end up in a small region in your detector, so the reconstruction efficiency of those resonances might be higher if you focus on highly boosted final states.
Can you quantify highly boosted again?
Yeah.
You're going to?
I'm going to, but you... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, disadvantages in this scenario are a lower cross-section because you only focus on highly boosted objects. And again, you might have some larger contributions from initial state radiation, underlying event, and so on, because you need a big cone size to catch the final state radiation of those resonances. All right, so I have been working over the last year on several of those projects where those techniques are applied. Graham was here, so I'm not going to be able to talk about all of those projects. I will focus on three of those. Graham was talking about the scenario where you have Higgs from a cascade decay, which is also boosted, and the Higgs goes to BB bar, and I think he was focusing also on the virtues in this scenario on the new physics searches and so on. I would try, or I would like to focus more on the subject issue. And in this sense, I will only discuss the TT bar Higgs production, C plus Higgs, and discuss in this specific case and compare subject techniques. And finally, also the Higgs in a boosted scenario where the Higgs decays to two Z bosons, where you can gain in production or in cross section compared to the four leptonic channel. Okay, so what is a jet? I mean, jet usually is only thought of as collimated spray of hadronic stuff in your detector. Why is there such a big interest in it, and what's the big deal about everything? I think this can be better understood. So those are more, by the way, high PT events observed at the ATLAS and at the CMS with invariant mass of 1.77 TeV already. So they have data for jets. They try to compare those events they observe in the detectors with theory, and at the moment it works out quite well. So this is, can be understood if you consider the whole event. So this is a general TT bar Higgs event, and you have contributions from underlying event, which means if you collide two protons, usually two quarks give you the hard interaction, or a gluon and a quark, and the spectators, they interact softly with each other and with color-connected partners and so on. So this is called underlying event contribution. Further, there is initial state radiation contribution, because here from the protons, before the hard interaction takes place, and the hard interaction is only this small part here in your whole event. So only this small part relates this whole event, this whole final state to your underlying theory, like the Zenon model in this case, glue-glue goes to TT bar Higgs. Before the protons, gluons, lead to this hard interaction, they radiate and have pretty hard, relatively hard jets coming from initial state radiation. Finally, after this hard process has occurred, the decay products of the tops and the Higgs and they lead to further radiation, which is called final state radiation in this sense. So overall, you have order 1,000 particles. And the whole picture can be cast in a more pictorial way with the usual QCD factorization picture, where you have here the hard interaction. You have the long distance physics out there, and hard distance physics and long distance physics, of course, on different time scales. So they kind of factorize, and you can describe this stuff independently, more or less independently from each other. But in the end, you have to take all information into account to reconstruct your underlying theory.
Are you going to generally be talking about low super-rapidity
no.
as well?
Oh, you mean
otherwise you're going to have initial state and unknown event pollution issues.
Yeah, but you have it also for low rapidity. I mean, you have it also in the central region of your detector. That's the point. So most of the initial state radiation goes down the beam pipe, that's right, but not all of it. I mean, that's the point.
No, yeah. So you still have that issue, but you're generally going to be doing that.
That's true.
That's
right, yes. Yes. Okay. So now you want to have a jet in this highly active environment. You want to define a jet, which is not very easy, but you can do it, of course. And you will be confronted with several issues. One of them is called splash-in, which means you have a cone of your jet, but it gets polluted by uncorrelated contributions from the underlying event, pile-up. Pile-up means you have a bunch of interactions, you have a bunch of protons passing each other, and while only one of those protons might give you an interaction which is hard, there might be several other interactions in such a bunch while passing, and they might pollute your jet or jet definition with soft radiation. So this is pile-up contribution. There's splash-out as well. I mean, usually you assume that jet radiation is soft and collinear, which means the decay products of final state radiation of your resonances is contained in a very narrow region, which is most of the stuff. But sometimes, I mean, you have a larger angle splitting, and so you might lose it because of the narrow jet definition. And one thing is heterogenization, because, I mean, you have the after shower process, there's a heterogenization process, and you span the strings over a large region, so some of the radiation might end up outside of your cone. This is a problem for called splash out. A further issue is the correct definition of a jet, because it has to be infrared safe. And this wasn't realized or appreciated fully among the experimentalist community for several reasons, for several years. Usually they had something which is called cone algorithm. So they produce a hadronic final state, and then they look at it and say, okay, we draw a cone based on some algorithm. We draw a cone around a hadronic active region. But such a definition is not infrared safe. And this is because of the Kinoshita-Lee-Nauenberg theorem. So what you want to have is something like this. This is a jet definition function. If you calculate an exciting order cross section, the virtual corrections of your process will lead to infrared divergences as well as the real emission part. But when you integrate over the phase space, which is here, let's assume it's a one-parton phase space at leading order, and also for the virtual contributions, you have a two-parton phase space for the real emission. But when the real emission partons get very close to each other, you want to be able to integrate over the one-parton phase space. So you need a jet definition which discriminates very collinear and soft contributions from the real emission process. The divergences in the virtual contributions and the real emission contributions, they have to cancel among each other.
Do
no.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, some do.
No, they do.
No.
You're talking about seeding.
That's right.
Yeah, so you should
right.
Say it differently.
Okay, there's one cone algorithm. Yeah, there's syscone. That's right.
Period. Right?
Yeah, syscone. Okay, I mean, there's syscone, which does. And there is.
The ones that don't, it's the seeding that's the issue. It's not.
Yeah, but this leads exactly to this problem. No. This is exactly the problem. Because if you want to compare a final state with something, because, I mean, okay, if you have a seed at some point,
when you talk about seeding, the issue appears, but that is separate from the definition in terms of the cutting phase space.
No, that's not true. It's not separate. Why should it be separate? Because let's assume you have
a seed. If I give you cuts on phase space up to any order, you're telling me I cannot define a Cohen algorithm in an infrared safe way with specifying cuts on phase space.
I'm telling you that if you have a seeded Cohen algorithm, it's.
Okay, well, now you've seeded it.
That's important, sorry. I mean, okay. This point I forgot. You have a seeded cone algorithm.
Okay, it's your seeding. I agree.
Okay, so, yeah, we're fine.
But you tell the rest of us what seeding is.
Yeah. Seeding is what I wanted to describe. So they have a look at the final state, and then they pick a point in this final state and draw a cone around it. So this is why I describe it that way. So this is seeding in the sense because it is nothing which self-adapts the jet to collinear or soft radiation in the event. And this means if you do the seeding and you spot a point more or less without taking soft radiation in this sense into account, you will end up in a situation where you get those contributions from next leading order which will not cancel based on this definition of the jet with the infrared in an infrared safe way. So this is, I can draw pictures if you want later on. It's
It's kind of a technical point.
But yeah.
But for some
people that don't work on cones tend to bash cones in exactly that way. But it's really the seeding, and you can seed in a way that makes it infrared safe, in principle.
Just so I understand the concept of the point of the seeding for this issue is that it's stopping you from doing a complete sum over all the states that would have been needed in the K-Len theorem. You're kind of excluding some of them by the definition of the
seeding. Yes.
Yeah. It's a coding issue, basically how to code fast and how you your seeding. But you can always define cutting phase space with a cone. That's perfectly infrared safe. I mean,
yeah,
urban Weimar jets are infrared safe objects.
That's why they were designed.
Yes, I know. By definition, they are, right? I mean, they explicitly satisfy KLM. It's only when you try to implement them in some coding software that you have the seeding issues. Yeah. So
why I was taking issue with this thing.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, experimentalists didn't care so much about this issue because, I mean, of course, they have a final state and that's not no big issue for them. But if you want to really compare observable with a Monte Carlo prediction, you have to take care of it. That's the only thing. Okay, so to solve those problems, you can either go to a non-seeded cone algorithm like SysCone, or you can make up some jet definition which is based on a sequential jet algorithm, which is called either KT algorithm, Cambridge-Arden algorithm, or anti-KT algorithm. I'm going to talk about this. And of course, there are different ways to recombine those partons. Usually, it's used the E scheme is used, and you just sum up the four momentum of those partons to make up the jet. All right. So this is the way a KT algorithm works. You have a distance measure in your space, which is delta R is just on the legal plot plane the distance between partons, and you have a distance parameter, which is here called R square, which just tells you when to stop the whole algorithm. And the KT algorithm takes care of the softest guys in this event. So you have the minimum of PT squared, which enters the distance measure, and you have the spatial distance in phi and eta for the partons. It starts off like find the smallest distance in dij or dib, and dib is only the distance of the parton with respect to the beam axis. And here is the PT of the parton with respect to the beam axis. You see. So find the smallest one. The smallest one are those. Then recombine them, which gives you something like that. Now you have recombined two of those, and this is your new set. You run the same algorithm again. Again, find the smallest one in this notion of this distance measure. This is going to be the smallest one. But now the combination IB is smaller than DIJ because DIJ would be the recombination of those two, while DIB is only the PT of this guy. And numerically, this is smaller than the combination of those two. So with respect to this measure, so we call this a jet. Remove it from the list of objects. Do the same stuff again. This time, this guy is the smallest one with respect to this measure. You remove it, you remove it, you remove it, and in the end, you found four jets based on this jet algorithm.
So each initial jet has, say, how many iterations you have to do? Like how many particles? Or
yeah, this depends on your event, but it can be 50, okay. Something like that, or can even be more. But depends on your cone size, of course. Depends on the busyness of your event.
So if I was a cone partisan, I'm a little bit of a cone partisan. I'm cone heads, little cone heads. I did a paper on it all the time. But what I would complain about with these sort of algorithms is it's hard to theoretically study these things. I mean, they're good for coding, but it's hard to theoretically study these things. And in particular, it's hard to prove things like factorization theorems,
yeah, sure,
with these objects. So have these actually been proven to factorize in, you know, I mean, Soper's involved, so he would make,
yes,
the attempt. But have,
exactly,
they actually done real proofs of these sort of algorithms and factorization and infrared safety?
Infrared safety has been proven,
okay,
definitely.
The factorization?
No.
As in any process?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about that fact.
I'm sure.
I mean, infrared safety has been proven. That's clear.
Yeah, it kind of.
Yeah.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. But factorization, I don't know how, maybe there's work to do.
Okay.
Yeah. And there are other definitions of distance measures. Cambridge-Arden just gets rid of the PT dependence here and just takes spatial information into account, which means here's delta Rij over R. And anti-KT is based on the hardest guys. So you take the inverse, the minimum of the inverse of PT, and you have again this distance measure, delta Rij squared over R squared. The nice part is, so what experimentalists were complaining about in the KT algorithm is they don't give very round shapes, so it's not a circular shape you obtain from such a measure. But you do get it for the anti-KT algorithm. So this is the most popular algorithm these days, and it's implemented in Atlas. And yeah, that use this right now. So the idea is now we have our sequential recombination algorithms. We have, with those sequential recombination algorithms, we have a recombination history. Because by combining this stuff, we can trace back. I mean, we can reverse this recombination and trace back through the history of recombinations and can apply some techniques to discriminate between gluon jets, quark jets, and maybe some resonance jets. This leads us to the jet substructure problem, because if you break up and reverse the combining, you get small jets, you get, in the end, maybe a microscope for boosted objects and resonances. And this additional information you can put in might gain, might pay off in the phenomenological study you want to do. So which tools have been invented for jet substructure? I'm only going to be going to talk about filtering, pruning, and trimming, which are really techniques applied to subjets. But there are also further techniques which make use of energy flow, like planar energy flow, because a gluon jet with respect to the energy flow through a specific region looks different than, for example, a top jet, because a top has a three-point decay and so on. So you can make up different observables which discriminate between gluon jets or top jets. Now, let's discuss how this is done. So let's, for example, take this as an event. We have contributions from underlying event, pileup, initial set radiation, and, of course, also the hard interaction. What you would do is, you would assume a fat jet, which is this red circle here, cone size, R equals 1.2, based on the Cambridge-Arden jet clustering algorithm. And now, of course, I mean, you can impose further event selection criteria and so on, but at the moment, we start off with a fat jet. Okay, let's have a look into this fat jet, and let's apply the procedure which is called filtering. Filtering and trimming are very simple procedures, because you just combine, I mean, you give them a cone size like R equals 0.2, based maybe on Cambridge-Arden, but it can be a different jet algorithm, doesn't matter. You recombine the constituents of this fat jet based on this new jet definition, which means you take the smallest ones, you recombine them, you get something like that. Those are now the smallest ones. You recombine them. Looks like that. Now, all constituents have a larger distance than R equals 0.2, which means all those guys are your subjets inside your fat jet. But you don't want to have all of them, because you would assume that some of them are from final radiation, state radiation. Others might be from underlying event, pretty soft. And let's assume this was a top. And you want to reconstruct the top mass correctly, you would only want to have maybe four or five of those guys, but not the very soft ones, because you assume that underlying event is much softer than the final state radiation of a boosted top. So you require, for filtering, a specific number of subjects, which might be three in this case. Trimming has a different procedure, a self-adjusting procedure, which says, I allow for the recombination all subjects which are harder than a specific scale. The scale is based on your fat jet PT. And maybe those are four instead of three, but could have also been only three or maybe only two. This is influenced by the choice of F in this equation. Now, pruning is a little bit more.
So it's essentially the same idea as when you just define the initial jet, except you're just taking sort of smaller size, smaller R value. Is that roughly the same?
Exactly. You take a smaller R value. I mean, it's a really simple idea in this sense, and you have to back it up with some more elaborate method.
That possibility of, say, you just have one jet, one hard fork, and give you a jet. Would you ever mistake it for having subjets? Like this?
Of course. I mean, if you have a quark or a gluon, quarks and gluons irradiate as well while going through the shower process, so they would eventually have more than probably would have more than one hard subjet. And this statement also depends on your cone size, of course, and so on. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit. I mean, jets are not unambiguously defined. If I, for example, start off with a fat jet of R equals 1.5 or something, I go down to R equals 0.8, probably I would still catch all finite state radiation of a gluon in this R 0.8 cone. So if I go to R equals 0.2, probably I wouldn't catch all finite state radiation.
You kind of just have to adjust based on the signal you're looking for?
Yeah, sure. That's the nice, I mean, that's the jet definitions and where you treat jets should help you in reconstructing the interesting particle you wanna detect or you wanna find in the experiment. And this ambiguity in defining jets and using those information in this sense should help you, and it can help you, and this is what I'd like to show in the second part. So pruning is more elaborate. There are two conditions, and you veto the merging if both hold true. So there is one asymmetry condition, which means the minimum of a merging PTI, PTJ, divided by their PT momentum combined. If it is smaller than Z cut, is one uncondition. The other thing is if there's a spatial difference or a distance in the Lego plot plane between two partons, if this is bigger, then this value here, this is another condition. If both hold true, you veto the merging, which goes like this. So in the first step, the distance between those two is smaller than delta than the D cut in this example. So this is fails, which means we merge it. Again, those other two, the distance is still smaller, we merge it. Now it goes on, and our R in this unequation is defined by mFET jet over PT jet, which might lead to such cones for the subjets. From this point on, when you have such a distance in the Lego plot plane, this condition is always true. Now you have a look at this condition. Those two are very asymmetric in PT, as you can see by the size of those circles. So this condition is also true. Both are true. The vetoing gets the merging gets vetoed, which means we get rid of the softer one. Same in this case, get rid of the softer one. And those look pretty similar, which means it fails the first condition, so you merge them. And this is the pruned jet. Pruning was one of the first methods, although being more elaborate than the others in this sense. Now, there has been a boost workshop.
Can you just once again motivate why you do all those processes?
Yes.
What do you mean with that now?
Yeah, so what you don't want to have is a soft wide-angle radiation. Because for your signal, you just say, it won't give me a huge contribution to my reconstructed mass of the heavy particle because it's soft. And you would assume at some point that this is not really correlated because you have a collinear and soft enhancement in your evolution of the finite state radiation. So most of the stuff will be close or it's collinearly enhanced. So most of the finite state radiation will not spread over a very big region. But the underlying event, which contributes in your whole fat jet more or less over everywhere, this you can veto by those requirements. So this is the motivation of this whole thing. Yeah, and you can adjust those parameters, of course. I mean, this is you can play with those C-cat and D-cat parameters.
You just want to identify what the hard stuff is.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So that's another question on motivation that you started talking about. I like this stuff, I think it's important, but the thing that bothers me about it is trying to define the error on what you're doing.
The error?
Yeah.
Has
any thought really gone into that? Like, so sure. At the end of the day, say you're going to use these processes, and you're going to say, well, I have X number of 4 jet events.
Right.
This seems like a signal because I shouldn't have X, I should have Y.
Right.
But that, with all of these procedures, it's unclear to me how the errors are defined and how the errors interfere with one another in these different, processes being done on jets.
That's right.
So what's the status on this sort of thing?
Yeah, no one of the theorists claims that what you simulate in a Monte Carlo shower is nature in the end. I mean, nobody does it, but the error is dominated by experimental uncertainties like the jet energy scale in your event or...
That's still vague, that's true.
Yeah, and yes, jet energy scale uncertainties and reconstruction uncertainties for example, later in the B-taking and so on, you have missing energy contributions and so on. This has all been evaluated by the experimentalists. So the theorists more or less give here algorithms based on some ideas how you would expect the resonances to look like after showering and hadronization. But if those methods really work out exactly the same way as done in a Monte Carlo program, no one can tell right now. So
it's ill-defined, the error.
The errors, yeah, of course, it's ill-defined.
I know it's smaller than generally scale. I mean, that's a big error, I agree. That's
yes.
A big problem, but how, if it's ill-defined, do we know it's...
Well, you can. What you do right now among the theorists is you make an analysis based on a Monte Carlo program. You compare it with this approach, which is also based on a Monte Carlo final state, and you can say a Monte Carlo final state treated this way reconstructs the mass better than treated the other way. But you can tell the experimenters, please have a look if this is true, and they should do it on data. And you cannot do it on data as a theorist. I mean, but this is true for all phenomenological approaches. If you make a cut on missing energy is widely smeared out. You'd never know exactly as a theorist if your result and you claim some significance after, let's say, 30 inverse femtobound, if this is really going to be the significance they're going to be able to measure in an experiment. So there is always an uncertainty if you do Monte Carlo studies in this sense. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say, it's necessary to say as a theorist, but there's no way we can avoid it.
So would you say it's a fair statement to say that at this point in time, people are just running Monte Carlo simulations and doing these algorithms on them to see what they can do, just as a principle sort of thing? So it's not clear that when you do these things and you get some increased significance, that really holds water because you can't define the error on the procedure you're doing.
Yeah.
Could you agree with that statement?
Partly, because there has been a full detector analysis on the BDRS study, which I'm going to talk about later on, which means they took the full detector uncertainties into account based on their analysis, and the analysis from this full detector simulation seems to be reproduced in nowadays data. So it's not as bad as just running a shower program and then claiming you have an improvement. Experimentalists already did a full detector simulation, and they could reproduce the improvement using those methods. So it's somewhat in between.
It's Monte Carlo, too.
Though. It's still Monte Carlo, but yes, but this is Monte Carlo information. I mean, yeah.
I don't know why when the experimentalists run the Monte Carlo, that makes it golden.
It doesn't make it golden, you're right. Of course, I mean, in this sense, you are right. It's not evaluated on data, in this sense, and you cannot claim that those methods will come out the same after running it on data. It's true.
Okay.
But we got as close as we could get to those simulations on data by including a full detector simulation from the experimentalists.
Fair enough. I think it's important. This is an issue I don't agree.
Yeah. Okay. So the comparison of those different techniques has been done in the Boost proceedings, which will appear pretty soon, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And you can see this is the unpruned plain jet mass, and we were running here a top sample. The PT of the top was between 500 and 600 GeV, which is kind of highly boosted, between low boosted and highly boosted, kind of intermediately highly boosted top of 500, 600 GeV in PT. And you can see filtering, trimming, and pruning with adjusted parameters for this PT ratio region works more or less the same. I mean, all of those three methods reproduce the top mass better than the unpruned, untrimmed, unfiltered approach. And you can see some improvement on that. All right. So let's have a look. If we know that different grooming techniques of the jets work differently, so this is an approach differently, so we have three different methods. Let's see how they work in practice. Now, this is the trailblazing analysis of Butterworth, Davison, Ruber, and Salam in 2008, and they applied filtering using a mass drop condition on the previously disfavored discovery channel of Z Higgs production at the LHC. So nobody thought that Z Higgs could be a reasonable Higgs discovery channel, but with their analysis, they showed that it might work out. So what they did is they had a Cambridge-Aachen algorithm of R equals 1.2, the Higgs decays to BB bar. The other C decays leptonically, it recoils against this Higgs. So the decay products will end up, hopefully, in this fat jet of R equals 1.2. And of course, because of this big cone size, they will collect also initial state radiation underlying event contributions. So what they did is they had a mass drop. They reversed the clustering algorithm. They, as long as there might occur such a mass drop, and they vetoed asymmetric splitting in this sense. So if gluons, for example, they would split asymmetric, usually they have one guy which is soft, the other guy which is hard. So they vetoed against those splittings and hoped that they could improve on the significance that this, what they have in mind, is really a Higgs jet and not a gluon jet. After such a mass drop has occurred, they do the filtering on those constituents which are dark here and required to take the three hardest subjets, recombine them, and use a B tagging on two of those three subjects, this and that. After doing that, they found something like this, a very nice Higgs peak over 120 GeV, a C peak for calibration, which is pretty nice, and a signal of a background ratio of 4.5 after 30 inverse femtobarn, which is just great, because now this is really a process which might contribute to the light Higgs discovery, and this is the most difficult region to discover Higgs.
Yes.
This is the original PRL paper they submitted. It's changed in different ways. So first of all, here they assumed 60% e-tagging efficiency. The ATLAS study, which is quoted here, only gave a 3.7 S over square root B, but they also found that the b-tagging efficiency is better than previously anticipated. They found a 70% b-tagging efficiency and a 1% fake rate, which is really great in those instances. All right, but this experimental study confirmed the whole approach and everything which, and at least encouraged all later studies on this subject. So we now have seen that grooming techniques work differently. They do provide probably different information, so why not combine those different methods to gain more insight on the underlying structure? In this sense, so we were, Dave Soper and I, we were comparing pruning and trimming, pruning for different Z-cuts and different shower programs. So here this is Pythia 8, Herbig, Pythia 6, and you clearly see with the parameters we chose an asymmetry in this mass plane. Now, that's nice. I mean, the asymmetry alone is not very interesting. But what's great is that you have a low correlation in the background, which is here just Z plus jets, but a high correlation in Higgs to Z, Higgs and Z goes to BB bar, lepton, lepton. Now, you can see that this is our signal region, and here this would be our signal region, like that. Now you shifted several background events out of this region, and in this sense you improve in S over B. Due to the fact that the pruning and trimming algorithms, as well as filtering, doesn't matter, have a high correlation in the signal but a low correlation in the background, you can improve in S over B, and we did this for the Higgs Z study. You can even optimize it for pruning for varying the parameters, so Z equals 0.05 gives you a larger asymmetry in the background than, for example, Z equals 0.2. And if you optimize it, you get those numbers. We backed it up with a likelihood ratio analysis. But practically, this is the cut-based method, and S over B improves from 0.67 to 1.3. And in S over square root B, you have only a mild improvement because there are not many events in this final state. So from 2.0 of the analysis from Gavin Salam and so on to 2.4 after applying pruning and trimming simultaneously. Now?
So that's the point where I would say,
yeah.
It looks good, but what's the plus minus? And is there anything to say on that, or is it just?
What's the plus minus? What do you mean?
In terms of error, when you do 1.2 or 0.
Yeah, sure. I mean, okay, so that's true. Practically, you reduce the number of events, but S over square root B, in this sense, if you go agnostically to the stuff and you don't ask maybe about experimental uncertainties or something like that, it improves because S over square root B improves, so you have a higher significance to see the signal over the background. In this sense, the method works better if you believe that the Schau programs reproduce nature. If you don't believe in it, one has to improve the Schau programs, and yeah, then all the simulations are probably in vain in some sense. Yeah. But the Schau reproduces data quite well. I mean, this has been shown just in recent analysis.
No, I think I agree with you. I think there's good reason to think that. I think this is an improvement. I'm just trying to quantify how much of an improvement is this. Is it really the 2 goes to 2.4 or the 2 goes to 2.4?
Okay. Yeah. You can argue about that. That's true. I mean, this, I'm not sure if you can. No, I wouldn't expect, to be honest, exactly those numbers to be correct in the end, or to claim that there's a 25% improvement in significance or something like that. It's just, I would ask the experimentalists to have a look at it, combine those two methods, do it like that, and hope that you can improve on that. It's at least an idea they should apply to their methods, and then, yeah. All right. So we have seen that they combined work stronger as a team, and what I expect is there's a reason that pruning and trimming work so differently on those jets. So maybe we can get insight into the color, for example, of the decaying particle and so on. But this is research which is done right now. Okay, another application of this idea has been done in the Higgs to ZZ decay, where one of the Zs decays hadronically, the other leptonically. So the gold-plated mode for as soon as the Higgs is heavier than 200 GeV, the gold-plated mode, which is Cz goes to 4 leptons, is dominating and provides a pretty good chance to detect the Higgs at a very early state, already 10 inverse femtobarn here. So, but there's a drawback in some sense. So the 4 leptons, the branching ratio of a Z to a muon, for example, is only 3%. So Z to leptons, if you include the electrons, is 6%. But reconstructing electrons is not as easy as reconstructing muons.
So, does that actually mean that we can expect, if the Higgs is not heavy, exclusion bounds early on the high mass region?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Here the problem is, I mean, if you talk about 7 GeV, you would require also a higher, I mean, it's stronger suppressed because you would go to a larger X and then the gluon contribution. So this is usually based on the Higgs gluon fusion process, and if you go from 14 TeV to 7 TeV, you would probe it at higher X, and then you have a larger suppression of gluon initial state than quark initial state. So if you can just, you cannot only increase it by a factor of 2 or something like that to get those exclusion bounds. But in general, it's true. If you go to 14 TeV, you would assume to have earlier exclusions at higher masses than at lower masses. Okay. So this is the process I would like to have a look at. And if you replace the decay of one of the Cs to two leptons by decay to quarks, you gain by a factor of 10, which is pretty nice in this sense. But of course, the final state is messier. You have more backgrounds. And so you have to evaluate if this is going to pay off or not. So this is, in total, a scenario of a naturally boosted object. The C boson is naturally boosted if the Higgs is heavy, which you can see. So we don't lose many events by applying a subjet techniques on boosted objects, because most of those guys are boosted, especially if the Higgs is 500, 600 GeV heavy. So what we did is we reproduced the 4 lepton gold-plated mode analysis, and then we did the semi-leptonic lepton-lepton-jet-jet analysis. Reconstructed one set, of course, leptonically, the other using filtering and mass drop, and applied pruning and trimming in the end to reconstruct the Z hadronically. And we did it for different Higgs masses. So the gold-plated mode is great in this sense that you have, at 14 TeV, for example, S over B is just huge. I mean, you don't have lots of systematic uncertainties from the experiment. They are going to be able to reconstruct the leptons fairly well. S over square root B after 10 inverse femtobarn is 6, 7, up to 8. And for 7TV, it looks quite different because there's not many events for this gold-plated mode. The fact that you have a very small branching ratio just leaves you with a pretty small number. If you have, for example, one inverse femtobarn data collected, you would expect only half an event in this sense at the LHC. There is no event, more or less.
Why don't we get just these pulses decaying?
Hadronically?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is pretty tough because then you have diejet backgrounds, and diejet backgrounds is in the millibarn region and not so much in the picobarn or femtobarn region. So. Yes, I mean, you would still. That's true. So if you have leptons, you pretty easily can kill QCD as a background. That's the nice part. Okay. Now this is what I just said. I mean, the SO square root B drops pretty fast for 7TeV and SO square root B. So especially for 7TeV, one might expect the hydronically, semi-hydronically mode to be a big improvement, which is what we did here. So this is the outcome of the semi-leptonic analysis for different Higgs masses. 7TeV is here and 14TeV. So S over B is not as good as in the previous analysis, of course. It goes down to 0.3 for 600GeV. As you can see here, there's just a huge background bulk, unfortunately exactly under the peak of the Higgs-Z resonance for 400GeV. And if we go to the previous slide, I mean, you can easily have here a side bin analysis or something like that for the signal. That's a nice feature for the leptonic mode. The semi-leptonic mode, on the other hand, comes with with more events.
What was the simulation path? You might have told us.
Yeah. So here, it's 4 leptons. You require 4 isolated leptons. You recombine 2 of the leptons to 1 C, the other 2 to the other C boson. And then the Z boson has to recombine to the Higgs mass, which is 350, 400 GeV. And you have usually a mass window, which was given here. So for 300 GeV, it can be plus minus 30 GeV. For 350, plus minus 50.
No, I meant the simulation in terms of the tools you use.
Okay, nice. Okay, so there's we use Pythia and Herbig plus plus, and then you recombine the jets using FastJet, for example, or more. I don't know what else you mean.
I was just wondering if you did the simulation in multiple.
Yes, we did. That's true.
Monte Carlo programs just to check.
That's true. Yeah. Of course, we did that.
Yeah. And you get the same number?
Yeah, we got more plus minus 20% or something, which is not bad for Monte Carlo tool. Yes, okay. Yeah, we did that, and we included the gluon fusion process as well as the vector boson fusion process in this simulation. So those small tips here, I don't know if you can see it, are from vector boson fusion, and the lower part here is from gluon fusion. All right. So those are the numbers. S over B goes down compared to the previous analysis. But S over square root B is still in a very good region, comparable to the purely leptonic analysis. And S over square root B for 7TeV is even not so bad, 3.6 after 10 inverse femtobarn. Of course, probably we won't have 10 inverse femtobarn at the LHC at 7TeV, but here it would still improve. The nice part is also if you have a fourth generation, the gluon, the loop for Higgs, gluon Higgs, would increase by a factor of 3. So a fourth generation, you can easily exclude or detect already at 7TeV with one inverse femtobarn at the LHC in this channel.
Do you really mean 20%, like across the board, is 20%, or is that just roughly,
roughly? Here in the mind, no, it's not so constantly. Yes. There's a dip.
Have you guys thought about using that as a way to define at least some aspect of an error? Because I think and the error is at least that, right?
It's even more interesting. It's even like we made this analysis with Herwig and Pythia, and for some subjet observables, we saw a very different shape for between Pythia and Herwig plus plus, which means either one of those programs is wrong, and you can test it on early data already, or I don't know what else could go wrong. I mean, they have different shower and different shower variables. some are, I mean, Harry++ is Angular ordered, Pythia 8 is PT ordered, or Pythia 6, earlier versions, is virtuality ordered. So we run all of them, compared them. And for some of the observables, especially Angular correlations, they turn out to be completely different. So this could probably be tested at the experiment already with early data and compared which shower program might reproduce nature better.
But all of these numbers correspond to one simulation test. You didn't pick the best one.
No, sure. Yeah, this, yeah. Yes. So let's jump to top tagging. I think, okay, some time left. So there are different approaches for top tagging. I just want to talk about the HEP top tagger with Heidelberg Eugene Paris top tagger, which is the only top tagger which really works in a busy environment down to 200 or 300 GeV in PT. We had to develop such a tagger for our TTBar Higgs project. Now, what's the motivation of TTBar Higgs? TTBar Higgs has been one of the major discovery channels at the LHC for low mass Higgs, like 115 GeV or something like that. But after a thorough study by Kamin and Schumacher, they found an S over B signal over background ratio of 1 over 9 and only a signal over square root B of 2.2. And particularly devastating is S over B in 1 over 9 because this means you need to know the backgrounds better than 10%, which you probably won't for TTBar Higgs, and the background is multi-jet events and so on. So you probably will never be able to observe this process in a with conventional methods in a measurement. So, yeah, there were several reasons. So the old studies, they had Monte Carlo programs. Then there were new PDFs, which came up. So those old analyses were based on CTEC 4, I think, and with CTEC 5, the cross-section reduced in the signal. They had, I mean, this whole previous study wasn't done very well. I mean, they were much more thorough in the sense. And right, yeah, and combinatorics is a problem in this final state. So you have four Bs. This is more or less the idea why a boosted scenario works better in this channel, because you have four Bs, which gives you six different combinations to reconstruct the Higgs mass. Now you have a B from the leptonically decaying top. You have a B from the hadronically decaying top. You have two Bs from the Higgs, and you can combine them in six different ways. And yeah, that's a problem. Now if you go into a boosted scenario, it looks differently. Because in a boosted scenario, you have one guy recoiling against the other. And now you eventually already, I mean, the B quarks, which end up in such a fat jet, is not four anymore, but maybe only two or three to recombine to the Higgs. So you reduce the number of possible combinations. That's nice. Further, the jet the event reconstruction efficiency is higher because, and this is a nice feature, but it has to be tested by the experimentalists as well. If you have a fat jet and you do decluster this fat jet, the subjets, they don't have a PT cut anymore. I mean, if you define a jet in an event, you need a PT cut already to define it perturbatively correctly or to discriminate hadronic activity region in your detector from unactive region. So you need a PT cut. But the subjets, which arise from the clustering of a fat jet, they don't have a PT cut anymore. And the W decay product, one tends to be hard, one tends to be soft. If you do this in a conventional analysis, the softer decay product gets lost very often. And the reconstruction efficiency of the TTBar Higgs final state is lower than in a boosted scenario. And the top tagger works like this. So you start with a fat jet, high PT fat jet. You decluster it based on some mass drop condition, and you don't stop after fulfilling this mass drop condition. So that's the difference compared to the BDRS study. You go down to the granularity structure of your fat jet. And based on those subjets you get after doing the declustering process, you have three conditions, which means, I mean, you require three of those subjets to recombine to the top mass, two to the W mass, and then there's an additional A cut, which I describe on the next slide. We don't have a BTEC because the reconstruction efficiency of our method is better than requiring a BTEC and applying conservative methods on the remaining constituents in your event. So the reconstruction efficiency to reconstruct the top is better than doing a BTEC, more or less, which has only 60% efficiency, and then you need to reconstruct the W, which where you also lose some events. And this is the A cut. So you see this is a TT bar sample, this is W plus jet sample, and this is the QCD sample. Based on those equations, you apply cuts in this plane. So requiring those conditions will project out those lines. And then we veto this region, and this abounds to the soft and collinear region. So most of the events from W plus jets get vetoed and QCD as well. But the interesting regions for the signal still remain. And in the end, what you get is something like this for the mass distribution of the top and the W. So the W is nicely peaked around 180 GeV, and the top is peaked around 172 GeV. Okay, so this is our reconstruction efficiency. It's a roughly 40% of a pretty large PT region for the Higgs, for the top. Other taggers usually only focus on regions which start from here 500 to 1 TeV or something like that. But such tops you won't observe from the standard model at the LHC. I mean, there's a huge number of 200 GeV tops or 300 GeV tops, but higher PT tops you won't observe from the standard model. So, in the other taggers? Or what do you mean?
You're just saying that you will not see tops with PT 500 and above.
Because there are no produce, there's no production process for tops. Yeah, I'm just talking about the production cross section for 500, 600 GeV tops from the standard model, which is practically zero or very small. Yeah, very small. Yeah. And, yeah, to. Well, at least the cross section is much bigger for 200 or 300 GeV. So if you okay. So, and you can see here this is delta P over P reconstructed, that the momentum of the top quark is very well reproduced by our tagged top. Okay, and this is the result for TT bar Higgs. Now, what we get is also we won't have a 5 sigma significance after 30 inverse femtobarn. We only found a 5 sigma significance after 100 inverse femtobarn. Here, this is with underlying event. This is without underlying event. So our tools are largely insensitive to underlying event contributions. But the crucial part is that our improvement in S over B goes from 1 over 9 to 1 over 2, which is pretty good in S over B. And while keeping the same significance after 30 inverse femtobarn, roughly 2.3. So with this method, the Higgs might contribute to the TT bar Higgs channel might contribute to the Higgs discovery, as well as maybe to some coupling measurement of the Higgs to the top. And it's difficult to have more processes than this one which really contribute directly to the Higgs top coupling. So I have some backup slides if people are interested. But now the conclusions are, I think that jet substructure measures can hugely improve the potential at the LHC to find new physics. But of course, all studies have been done on Monte Carlo level, and so they have to be reevaluated on real data, which we cannot do as theorists. But we would like to ask the experimentalists to have a closer look at it, and at the moment they do. So the exchange between theory community and experimental community is very intensive in this field, also spurned by the BOOST proceedings and BOOST conferences, which are held every year. And there's going to be some results from the BOOST proceedings within the next 2 or 3 weeks. So thank you.
Can they already with data do? Are they already doing some studies of this type?
Sure, yeah, they do. So there is like DieJet or something like this.
Yeah.
They already do this, yeah. And there's also W plus jets, for example, which is a question if you can observe W plus jets, where the W decays hadronically. So compared to a QCD background, and I always thought it's not possible, but obviously they made a Monte Carlo study and it seems to be possible already with one inverse femtobarn at LHC 7. Let's see what data says, but they try to do that. And so it's not like I'm just talking here about some ideas from theorists and it's completely decoupled from what experimentalists do. No, it's really a close collaboration in this sense.
It was driven by the theorists.
It was driven by the theorists. That's true, yeah. I mean, yeah, okay. There's John Butterworth, who was one of the first guys applying those subject methods. I mean, the very first guy was probably Mike Seymour, who was using those methods. But of course, there was also pretty soon after that, Butterworth jumped on it, and he is in Atlas, and so he pushed it a lot. Yeah, he is contributing to this, and this BDRS study is a joint collaboration of experimentalists and theorists. So, yeah, it's a joint enterprise.
CMS has also been on it, too.
Yeah, CMS is somewhat behind, I have to say. So they do this for TOPS. They were using an idea from the Johns Hopkins people for TOP tagging. They were employing it or implementing it in their framework. But so far they didn't fulfill the Higgs study. And I think that CMS has a bigger issue with their HCAL. The resolution from the HCAL is not as good as from Atlas. So they have a smaller radial profile on the HCAL. And those jets highly rely on HCAL information for their reconstruction. Let's see if they can do as well as the Atlas people. Yeah. Yeah, but practically they are also looking for this stuff.
Well, all right, let's thank Karina. And so we will be going to dinner. Will you talk to me?
Yes. Sure.
Yeah, at 7:30 or so. What's the plan?
I don't. I have no plan.
Did you talk to each other?
We were planning to go to dinner later, like 7:30 or something like that. So,
okay.
Of course, well, just let me know.